morning, we're ready to move on to the second matter on our oral argument calendar. So if council will take a seat at table. Mr. Raggetts, have you seen opposing counsel?
Opposing counsel's right here.
Oh, there you are. Very good. Thank you so much. So I'll just ask the marshal to call the first case. Please take whatever time you need to settle in. Or second case, excuse me.
Calling A231196, State of Minnesota Respondent versus Janelle Lorraine Johnson, Appellant.
And I'll make just a few quick remarks. Again, please take your time. As you go to the podium, make whatever adjustments you need. It does go up and down. The microphone can be moved around. We want to make sure that we capture your remarks because a recording is maintained by the Court of Appeals and later made available on the court's website. Before you start your remarks, to keep our record really clear, we ask that you identify yourself as well as the client you represent, and then recognizing that we hope for a conversation with you about this case, we ask that you keep your eye on the clock. It should show you how much time you have remaining in the argument. We look forward to talking to both of you. So with that, counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Dan Kohler, and I represent the appellant, Janelle Johnson, in this matter. I was listening to the argument of the case before ours, and we were discussing whether it had been preserved for trial, and here every issue deals with unobjected to error. Appellant understands that the modified plain error test is a heightened standard versus when things have been objected to. However, I do think she meets the burden in this case to show that these errors were plain error. They did affect her substantial rights, and the interests of justice do require this court to give her a new trial.
Counsel, on the substantial rights question, though, you seem, in a sense, to be relying on your representations that this was a weak case for the state. I can't imagine a case much stronger than this.
So, I'm not exactly sure how to answer that. The fact, and we went into it in the brief, but there's numerous cases. Well, in fact, one of them we cited to, State v. Underwood, talked about the fact that when it's primarily credibility determinations and there's no other significant corroborating evidence, that's the definition of a weak case. And that's before we get into the fact.
Is Underwood a case with confessions and admissions?
I did not cite to any, no.
Okay.
So, and we've got a case here where there were competing confessions, and that was literally the only evidence that tied Ms. Johnson to the shooting was the testimony, the statements she made to law enforcement while she was intoxicated at the scene. The part of the transcript that always gets me is when she called dispatch to report the shooting and confess. And they asked her who else was there with you. And instead of saying my husband Austin, she just jumps right in with again, I'm the one that shot him.
And shot him three times, which turned out to be correct.
Correct, which anybody at the scene probably would have known.
But in her testimony at trial, she changed that to no, there were only two shots that I heard.
Inconceivably, the jury could have found her uncredible in both instances and still found her not guilty. They didn't. But they could have said, her trial testimony doesn't make a ton of sense. We understand she was intoxicated at the time. We don't really believe the confessions either. I don't think there's enough evidence to prove that she committed this beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's because all of the, what could be claimed to be corroborative evidence, just as well corroborates the fact that Austin pulled the trigger three times. And some of the circumstantial evidence is actually stronger that he was there. He's the one that brought the gun. He's the one that put it away. He's the one that wasn't intoxicated. And so out of all of this evidence, it literally boiled down to who do we trust? The Johnson that testified under oath or the Johnson that told several stories to law enforcement, friends, and family the day after the incident? And then we've got the situation where the jury told us it was a weak case. If it's a strong case, the jury doesn't say, we're not clear who pulled the trigger. And that was the note. And then later on after that, they said, we've reached an impasse. We need some
counsel,
help.
You know, in terms of the jury's note, I think there's an argument made in the state's brief that interprets that note a bit differently from the way you do, and I'm trying to capture it, so I may not have it quite right, but you imply that the note is suggesting the jury didn't know who pulled the trigger, but it seems to me it's more about how they whether, you know, how do they reach the determination, which is a legal issue as opposed to a factual one. So help me understand your position more clearly. Yeah.
With respect to the note, the question was along the lines of, it was dealing with intent, but it was saying how can we find if she intended to pull the trigger? And I wanna make sure I get the language right, so if you'll excuse me as I flip through the brief. Could it be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, the third element, that the defendant has acted with the intent to effect the death of a person who died by gunshot if it is not clear as to who pulled the trigger? Now, I don't know how else not clear as to who pulled the trigger.
The beginning of the question is about could it be proven, and the district court referred the jury back to the instructions about what proof is required. So I guess I'm, you know, ultimately this issue about the district court's handling of the jury question, you know, there are a couple of prongs to it, but one of them is to show that it, you know, caused prejudice to your client, and I'm just struggling with your argument in that regard. So.
The argument in that respect is largely stems from the fact that, well, the best analogy I can come up with, and it's not great, if you give me 30 seconds, I worked my way through undergrad at St. Thomas in IT, technical support. Supporting users, faculty, staff. We'd dictate notes or we'd type up notes after our service calls, and lots of times we'd use the phrase RTM. It was out of frustration. It meant read the manual because we were responding to things that should not have needed a response. You would never tell a user that. You always go in, you try to fix it, you talk with them, you don't send them an email that says read the manual. That's the closest analogy we've got to this note. The
but
jury
in reality,
was
at the trial court, isn't that what we usually say when they have a question?
It's how it was said, and it's where the error is plain. It's unequivocally plain error to not bring the jury into open court in front of the defendant to answer a question. That's established. I don't know why the state didn't concede that. They cited no case law when they opposed it, but it is. It's plain error. The question is, does it affect substantial rights? And in almost every case I could find, this court has said no. But in this particular case, I do think the evidence was weak. I don't know how it can be looked at as a strong case when the corroborative evidence points towards Austin just as much as it does Janelle. But beyond that, the court, when the jury said they were at an impasse, the court did bring them in. When they wanted to review evidence, the court did bring them in. It was when they said, you know, it's not clear to us who pulled the trigger. It was just, look at the instructions again, the same instructions they had with them the whole time. Almost like, what do you not understand about this? And I know that wasn't the court's intent. And this is plain error analysis because all of the parties agreed this is how he should proceed. But that doesn't change the fact that Ms. Johnson did have that right to have that addressed. Give it the solemnity of being in open court. They get to look at Ms. Johnson while the judge tells them, I'm just going to ask you to look back at the instructions. Leave it at that. And when it comes to the fourth prong of plain error analysis, when we're trying to decide whether the interests of justice actually require you to take action, even if all of the three prongs are met. The strongest argument for this court is the fact that the state says that this was not even error, much less plain error. So the state's arguing for the proposition that we don't need to bring the jury into the presence. Like, the system of justice has made it very clear, rules of criminal procedure and the case law, that this was inappropriate. We let it slide because it rarely affects anybody's substantial rights. But it's gotten to the point where we're treating it like it's not even necessary. So that, I think, is the best argument for the fourth prong. With respect to, as long as we're here, with respect to the state's argument that we waived arguments regarding the note, the law is laid out on page 18, 19 of appellant's brief. The facts and the application of those facts is discussed on pages 20 and 21. It starts with a discussion about how Johnson's substantial rights were prejudiced, and it ends with saying this error did have a significant impact on the verdict against Johnson. I don't know how that can be construed as a waiver. But in the end, the crux of the argument goes to the argument made in close. The note itself is largely there to support the fact that this is a weak case. The strength of the evidence was not strong. And the case on point primarily is the Portillo case. And it does stand in juxtaposition to the Young case, which is actually discussed in Portillo. In Portillo, the Supreme Court noted that it was mentioned three times. There was no longer a presumption of innocence. Here, it was just once that the prosecutor said, it goes away and you must find him guilty. But in Portillo, that was followed by instructions by the district court. The district court instructing on the presumption of innocence. That didn't happen here. That happened before the argument. Now, in Portillo, the court said that wasn't even enough. But the fact is that the court didn't give any further instructions on presumption of innocence after that statement. In Portillo, the state walked through all of the elements of the offense and the evidence that supported a conviction before they got to the point where they used that language, no longer has the presumption. Here, all of those elements were discussed after the state told the jury, the presumption goes away, you must find her guilty. The surrounding statements that were made in both arguments are also dissimilar. Portillo did spend more time, and I won't read directly from the decision, but talking about, you know, we've been through all the facts, we've been through all the evidence, you've seen this, now this is our final argument. All of that led up to you being able to say, we found this person guilty, we're not presuming him innocent, but not before then. And then there's the fact that, so far as I'm aware, there were no jury questions in Portillo. And I can't think of another way to interpret the question, not clear who pulled the trigger, and we're at an impasse when the only issue was who pulled the trigger, as it being a strong case, or as it not having, in the words of the case law, because, well, those questions are literally the definition of reasonable doubt. I mean, if they were not clear, their obligation was to find her not guilty. But in this case, there's a reasonable likelihood that the misstatement in close did have a significant effect on the jury verdict because the case was close. And that's why we're asking this court, respectfully, to vacate the conviction, remand this matter for a fair trial. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Thomas Raggetts. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent respondent in the state of Minnesota in this matter. My plan was going to be to focus on the prosecutorial error argument this morning, but I think I'll start with the argument about the jury question, since that's been discussed recently, and I think that is not a particularly difficult question here. And I want to be clear about the argument I make in my brief, which I think is clear in the brief. There are two questions here. Was there prejudice from the fact that the answer wasn't delivered in open court? And was there error and prejudice in the substance of the answer? And on the open court portion of it, if you look at my brief, my only argument there is there was no prejudice. An appellant hasn't even argued prejudice. How could there be prejudice merely from the fact that it was delivered in writing, as the defense agreed to, as opposed to stated in open court? So there's no prejudice there, and that takes care of that part of the problem. I'm not arguing it doesn't violate the rule, although all rights can be waived. The defense waived the right to be present here. Now, the defendant didn't personally waive it, but appellant hasn't cited any case law saying this is one of those rights that has to be personally waived by the defendant, not by defense counsel. Again, the defense agreed to this. So the only real issue here, as appellant essentially acknowledges in his brief, is the substance.
You're referring waiver by defendant's attorney not objecting. Right.
The defense attorney went beyond that. The judge said everyone has agreed to the substance of the answer and how it should be delivered by note.
But there wasn't an explicit, I mean, maybe I misunderstand the record, so you correct me, but my understanding is that there wasn't an explicit discussion about the fact the defendant wasn't present.
Right. So there was a discussion in chambers, and they came out of chambers, and the judge said, everyone has agreed that we're going to answer this question as follows by note. So clearly, in chambers, defense counsel said, yes, we're fine with the substance and with doing this by note. Again, the defendant wasn't present in chambers, at least as far as we know from the record. There certainly is no on-the-record statement by the defendant, I agree to this. But again, there's no case law that says there has to be. We're in plain error land here. And the critical point on the mode of delivery is just, appellant hasn't even argued prejudice from mode of delivery. If you look at page, I think it's 18 of appellant's brief, she concedes the issue comes down to substance. And there is no plain error in the substance. As this court knows, this is the typical response from a judge. Go back to the jury instructions. The jury instructions here are not challenged. They set out all the elements, everything the state had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. The jury essentially asked a theoretical question. Well, if we're not sure who pulled the trigger, could we still find her guilty? They didn't say we can't. And the jury questions answer that. So there's no prejudice from the substance. Certainly there is no plain error here where there's no case law that says you can't do this in a situation like this. And it's important that plain error has to be error that's so clear and obvious that, in this case, Judge Brand was derelict in her duties by not doing something different, even though the defense agreed to this. Under plain error, you need prejudice. And you also have the fourth prong of the plain error test, and there's no argument in appellant's brief about the fourth prong. The fourth prong goes beyond the facts of the case. In Prozinski, the Supreme Court said it has to be the sort of error that casts the judicial system in disrepute in general. It isn't just there was prejudice in this case. So that argument's been waived. It's not in the brief anywhere. There isn't any even acknowledgement of the fourth prong existing in the brief. But regardless, there's no prejudice, there's no plain error. And unless the court has other questions on the jury question issue, I'll go back to the Portillo issue. And I want to make two arguments on that. First, this court doesn't even need to reach the issue because just as in Thompson, it could find no prejudice here, and there wasn't prejudice here. Thompson's a case, I said it in my brief from the Supreme Court, that postdates Portillo. And then my second argument is that appellant can't meet his burden of showing that there was error here, much less error that was so clear and obvious that it meets the plain error test. So on the prejudice point, there's three things I want to say. First of all, let's look at what actually was said here. The prosecutor did not make multiple misstatements of the presumption of innocence, as in Portillo. The statement was not in rebuttal, and Portillo emphasized how that was important. It was one of the last things the jury heard. In fact, the prosecutor only made one two-sentence statement toward the beginning of his closing argument before he discussed all the evidence, and then, importantly, the defense addressed the presumption of innocence at length after the prosecutor did. So all those things distinguish this case from Portillo, and that's point number one on prejudice. Point number two on prejudice is that Judge Brand did correctly instruct the jurors on the presumption of innocence.
Judge Brand's instructions were before the closing arguments, is that right?
They were. And I have two things I want to say about that. First of all, Thompson, which again predates Portillo, says appellate courts must, or postdates Portillo, says appellate courts must presume the jurors followed instructions. So if you presume the jurors followed the instructions here, they knew everything about the presumption of innocence they were supposed to know. And the fact that it was first here, I think, is actually stronger than in Portillo, where it was second. Because here, the jurors had already been told, hey, if the lawyers say anything later about the law that is different from what I tell you, you got to follow what I tell you. So the jurors had already heard about the presumption of innocence. They had already been told, these are the definitions you have to follow, no matter what the lawyers say. So by the time The jurors were hearing the prosecutor's statement. If they thought, that's not really the same thing as what Judge Brand told us, well, they'd already been told, you got to go with Judge Brand then. So that's point number two. Jurors are correctly instructed before they hear this from the prosecutor. And then the third point is the evidence here was very strong. I'm not aware of any case that has ever described a situation with multiple confessions as being weak. So we've got multiple confessions.
Counsel, I think that the strongest point from appellants on that regard is that the state has no evidence in the record that I'm aware of that rules out the husband.
That
everything that points to the wife, to the defendant, appellant, apart from, of course, her own statements, is evidence that could be equally applied to the husband.
It's true there isn't any sort of DNA evidence or video footage or anything like that, but I think not only do we have multiple confessions, not only to law enforcement, but to her very close family members who didn't indicate there was any sort of suggestion that she was covering for her husband or there was no sort of wink and a nod there. We got the fact that she's drunk and more likely to make a rash, bad decision than her husband who doesn't drink. She's got the strong motive here. There's no testimony about the husband having a strong motive. And I think it's really important to look at what was actually said in these confessions because what she told law enforcement and her family explains the physical evidence in a way that her self-serving statements at trial do not. The victim here, well, first of all, blood was found on the deck of the home, and then the victim's body was found some distance away from the deck. He jumped over the deck, ran in his bare feet away from the house. He was shot in the back. He was found face down in the snow. He was shot 3 times. That's the physical evidence, and that perfectly fits with her confessions. But then at trial, she says, well, I was ahead of them, and I heard a couple shots when my husband was back with the victim, and then we left. Well, she doesn't say, well, there was one shot, and then there was a long pause, you know, that before the other shot when he'd run away from the house some distance and was shot in the back and fell down in the snow. So the physical evidence doesn't fit with what she said at trial. It fits perfectly with what she told family members and law enforcement. And when you take that along with Judge Brand's instruction here, and the way the prosecutor's single statement about the presumptions has happened, that's what makes this a case where there is no prejudice, and you don't need to reach the plain error issue. But I will now address that.
And the counsel, there was no evidence that the husband ever indicated he had fired a shot.
Right. There was no indication he'd even used that gun before, where she had used that gun before. And there was talk about how, well, he's the one who brought the gun. But there was testimony at trial that he brought the gun because she told him to. That's how the sisters read her statement, Austin, gun, or Austin, drawer, or whatever it was. Right. So that was how they interpreted it.
She basically, as part of those admissions, indicated she took the gun out of his pocket.
And right. Used it. Right. She said she took the gun from him, and there was nothing that suggested that was implausible. I mean, they found a holster. It would have been easy to grab the gun off him. She admitted she'd used it before. And I think really the critical facts here are the way the body was found away from the house. This wasn't boom, boom, boom. This was he was shot on the deck, there's blood there, and then he runs, and as he's running away, she shoots him in the back, and that's what she admitted to her friends, to her family and to law enforcement, not once but repeatedly. So on the issue of whether there was error here that's plain, again, I want to emphasize that plain error has to be so clear and obvious that Judge Brand was derelict in her duties by not correcting it, even though the defense didn't object. I've set out on page 14 of my brief, if an issue is reasonably debatable, it's not plain error. And I provided this court with a little diagnostic aid here, which I've never done before and I hope is helpful, with all the different language used. And you can see from this, the judge told the jury repeatedly, the presumption of innocence goes away or remains unless and until the defendant has been proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. That's what the defense said, too. And then the prosecutor says, the presumption only remains with her until the state has proven the essential elements by proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Once the elements are proven, the presumption goes away and you must find her guilty. That is very different than Portillo. What the Supreme Court really didn't like in Portillo was that the prosecutor said, before deliberation, the defendant has already lost the presumption of innocence. The prosecutor said 3 different times in rebuttal, the defendant no longer has that presumption of innocence. The prosecutor didn't say that here. The prosecutor said essentially the same thing the judge said. Once everything's proven beyond a reasonable doubt, then the presumption of innocence goes away. If you look at the argument as a whole, what the prosecutor's arguing here was very much like what the prosecutor argued in Young, which the Supreme Court cited favorably in Portillo. Not that the defendant was not entitled to the presumption of innocence, but that it had been removed by proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Again, the prosecutor never said it no longer applied to the defendant even before the jurors began their deliberations. And I think the case that this one is perhaps closest to is not Portillo, but Vu, V-U-E, which is also cited in Portillo, where the Supreme Court said it was fine that there the prosecutor argued that the defendant has now lost the presumption of innocence as a result of the evidence you have heard. Well, that's what the prosecutor told the jury here, same as what the judge told the jury. Once the facts are proven beyond a reasonable doubt, the presumption of innocence goes away. Not it's already gone, you don't even think about it in deliberations, not it's already been lost, but it's very much like what happened in Vu here. And given what the Supreme Court approved of in Portillo, that the prosecutor said in Vu, at the least this is a reasonably debatable issue, which means it cannot be plain error. So appellant can't meet his burden, which is his burden here, of showing there was error and it was plain. On prejudice, I acknowledge that under the modified test, the burden's on the state, but there was no prejudice here for the three reasons I've already explained. I think I've addressed all the points on the jury question issue, so unless this court has additional questions, I will relinquish my final 2.5 minutes.
Any questions for the panel? Doesn't look like it. Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. Briefly in rebuttal with respect to the jury question, the state argued that it was waived. There is a case cited in my brief, State v. Farr, F-A-R-R, 357 Northwest 2nd 163, that actually does specifically hold that counsel can't waive that on behalf of defendant. That is something that would need to be on the record, which again underscores how casually we're treating the requirement that these things be conducted in open court. But other than that, I think the parties have stated their respective positions on whether the evidence is strong or weak. My explanations for why the multiple confessions actually underscores why they're not credible, why her intoxication works in her favor, not against her, but most of all because the jury came forth and told us, we're not clear on who pulled the trigger. How should we proceed? And then after the judge said, look at the instructions, they came back again and said, we're at an impasse. What should we do? The jury clearly struggled with this, and they don't struggle with strong cases. And that's why I'm asking this court to vacate Ms. Johnson's conviction and remand for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Our thanks to both lawyers in this case. We very much appreciate hearing from you. It helps the court. The matter is now submitted to the court for decision. We will issue a written decision within the statutory timeline. Thank you.